On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jack Kerouac hit the American road in 1947, wrote it up in a gush in 1951, and 6 years later, in 1957, On the Road was there for all. Jazz, sex, drugs, blue jeans, black coffee, and the highway. It was quickly an icon, a touchstone of the Beat Generation, and much that followed, a symbol of the wild and free and searching. But searching for what? Here's Kerouac himself, riffing on the experience of On the Road.
So Dean and I raced on to the East Coast. At one point, we drove a 1947 Cadillac limousine across the state of Nebraska at 110 miles an hour, beating hotshot passenger trains and steel wheel freights in one nervous, shuddering snap-up of the gas. We told stories and zoomed east. There were hobos by the tracks, wino bottles, the moon shining on wood fires. There were white-faced cows out in the plains, dim as nuns. There was dawn, Iowa. Mississippi River at Davenport, Chicago by nightfall.
Joining me today from New York is Joyce Johnson, author of Minor Characters, a memoir of her life with the Beats and her love affair with Kerouac in the on-the-road years. She's the award-winning author of three novels, including Come and Join the Dance, and has taught creative writing at Columbia and NYU. Joyce Johnson, it's really an honor and wonderful to have you with us today. Thanks a lot for being here.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
Also with us from New York is John Leland, reporter for the New York Times and author of the book Why Kerouac Matters, The Lessons of On the Road. They're Not What You Think. Newsweek says no one has written better and more intelligently about Kerouac. John Leland, thank you very much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom.
Joyce, my goodness, you were there when it happened.
I was there.
You've got this great piece. It's going to be on VanityFair.com describing that moment. Amazingly enough, you're right at his elbow when Jack Kerouac, 1957, a few minutes after midnight, picks up the New York Times and reads the review that would change his life and maybe something about the country. Describe that moment for us.
Well, Jack had come to New York earlier, just a few hours before he landed in New York after a long bus ride from Orlando, Florida. He was so broke, I had to lend him $30 for the fare. Maybe if it hadn't been for me, he never would have been in New York at that very moment. But anyway, around midnight, we went out to the newsstand on 66th Street and Broadway, which was near where I had my apartment, and got the first paper off the pile, and there was that review. And the interesting thing about that moment that sort of haunted me ever since was the fact that Jack wasn't celebratory. I was saying, wow, this is great.
Here's the New York Times, Gilbert Milstein, calling him the avatar of the Beat Generation, saying On the Road would be as important as Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises. It doesn't get much better than that.
I know, and all Jack said was sort of, it's good, isn't it?
He was 35 years old. You were his 21-year-old girlfriend, aspiring
right.
novelist. And that wasn't good enough, or it was the wrong kind of praise?
Well, I think there were probably a lot of things going on in his head at that time. On the Road for him was an old book. He'd written it in 1951, and in between 1951 and 57, he'd written nine other books in which he felt he'd far surpassed On the Road. And then the editing process of On the Road, had been so miserable. He'd been forced to make or accept so many changes that I think he felt the book was very compromised. Mm. Although he didn't say that to people very much, but I think he had very, very mixed feelings about it.
And you were there at his elbow, John Leland. We'll look at exactly what it came to be stand for, how it got sort of reified, but remind us of the history. I mean, after all, this is getting to be long ago history. It was in the 40s when he and Neil Cassady were making their cross-country trips. It was 51 when he famously sort of pasted together a long scroll of paper, jammed it in the typewriter, and just wrote the whole thing, at least first draft, in one long paragraph.
Well, it's funny. We all write like that now, thanks to word processors. We don't get up and change the typing paper, and we don't hit the return in that way. But, yeah, well, it can be a little bit misleading. Kerouac was constantly writing scenes in his journals and in his letters to friends and revising them, and he would write a scene to Allen Ginsberg, and then he might write the same scene in a letter to his friend Ed White or somebody else. And he was working on this material all the time. So when he sat down in April of 1951 and wrote this in 3 weeks, he was really drawing on a lot of previous versions and previous drafts. And he had written 3 drafts of the book before that.
What was it that this came so quickly to stand for, John? I mean, you've got your own take on what Jack Kerouac meant to say and said, and we will look at that. But this hit American culture at a particular moment, and it became a particular kind of icon. How would you describe it, John?
Well, like any good book, it's got a number of stories going in at the same time, and they call to us in different ways. The most obvious is that his character, Dean Moriarty, who's the Neil Cassady character who leads him on the road, is just about the most compelling character in American literature. He's the circus that every boy wants to join. He's having wonderful sex. He's having wonderful adventures. He's completely indifferent to the wreckage he leaves behind. But there's another book there that is just as important, and that's the story of Sal Paradise, the narrator, who's the Kerouac figure in it. And he is searching for something. He's searching for meaning in life, how he's going to be a man in this changing world around him, and how he's going to relate to his male friends, how he's going to relate to women in his life and work. And there's a spiritual quest in it as well. He's really searching for God. At one point, Kerouac was asked to describe the themes of the book, and he said, it was about two Catholic buddies in a search for God, and we found him. So there are those two, there's something for everyone there. There's that call to wild, irresponsible adventure, and there's also that search for God and search for meaning and a search to figure out who you're going to be in the world. And those two things are calls that still speak to us.
Joyce Johnson, you and John both, though, write about how Jack Kerouac was not entirely happy with the way his book and message got picked up by the sort of, beat successor hippies 60s and all that followed. Why not?
Well, he was totally unprepared for the kind of success that he had. Almost any writer would have been unprepared then. It was really the time when the mass media really suddenly exploded. There was television. Jack was one of the first writers to go on TV talk shows. So the message got spread of the Beat Generation got spread far and wide, but it kept being, as it was spread, it was distorted. It sort of lost its meaning, and what people glommed onto, because the 50s were such a bland, repressed, frustrating time, what attracted them was the whole message of, wow, live life for kicks, sex, drugs, irresponsibility, that part of the book was the part that captured a lot of the public imagination. There was a lot of outrage, of course, against the book as well. A lot of the attention Jack got was extremely hostile, but that's what the Beat Generation came to stand for in the minds of most people. And very, very soon, within weeks of the book's publication, Beat became corrupted into Beatnik.
Let's keep Jack Kerouac in our ears. Here he is on one of those talk shows that he appeared on, 1959, on the Steve Allen Plymouth Show. Steve Allen's playing the piano in the background, and Jack Kerouac's talking about On the Road and spirituality.
Well, a lot of people have asked me, why did I write that book or any book? All the stories I wrote were true, because I believed in what I saw. I was traveling west one time at the junction of the state line of Colorado, its arid western one, and the state line of poor Utah. I saw in the clouds, huge and massed above the fiery golden desert of Evenfall, a great image of God with forefinger pointed straight at me through halos and rolls and gold folds that were like the existence of a gleaming spear in his right hand, which saith, come on, boy, go thou across the ground. Go moan for man. Go moan. Go groan. Go groan alone.
Jack Kerouac reading in 1959 on the Steve Allen Show. I got to get a piano in here. That would really pep things up. Wow. That jazz tempo, though, he is so into it, Joyce. I mean, the sort of beat rhythm of that
prose seems as important to him almost as what the words say.
Oh,
can I interrupt for just a second?
Sure,
here? I'm sorry.
Sure.
Joyce won't tell you this, but it's through Joyce and her work that we have those words published, because that was, he was reading there from the book that became Visions of Cody that Joyce was able to get published.
Thank you, Joyce.
After everyone had rejected it during his lifetime.
Thanks for that. And he's, but it's whether on the road or there, that jazz music is central.
Well, the voice was so important to Jack. He once wrote in a letter to Neil Cassidy, "The voice is all," and you know it was really his greatest preoccupation, finding the voice. He began, as he saw it, he began to find it in On the Road, but it really, for him, and there are critics who agree, it really flowered fully in subsequent books, Visions of Cody, mm-hmm. for example. It was that music, the sort of beat that he was out to capture.
Here's a little bit more of Kerouac, an undated recording of Kerouac reading from On the Road, embellishing the original text, here describing a night at a San Francisco club.
"Wow, Frisco nights. The end of the continent then, and the end of the road, and the end of all dulled out. Lampshade was roaring around with trays of beer. Everything he did was in rhythm. He yelled at the waitress with the beat. Hey now, baby, baby, make a way, lampshade coming your way. And he hurled by her with the beers in the air and roared through the swinging doors in the kitchen and danced with the cooks and came on sweating back. And Ronnie Morgan, I call him Ronnie Morgan, who'd earlier in the evening performed at the Hey Now Club, I call it the Hey Now Club, screaming and kicking over the mic, now sat absolutely motionless at a corner table with an untouched drink in front of him, staring gook-eyed into space, his hands hanging at his sides till they almost touched the floor, his feet outspread like lolling tongues, his body shriveled into absolute weariness and entranced sorrow, and what all was on his mind."
Hey now, baby, baby, and Jack Beatty, Jack Kerouac reading from On the Road. Let's take a call from Michael in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I have to say, being the next generation of a French-Canadian family, growing up in a textile mill town of New Bedford, a lot like Lowell,
Jack Kerouac's hometown. Yep.
I saw the similarities in his writing and his thinking in late night discussions of poetry in Harvard Square or Northampton, yeah. In trips across Canada and especially Quebec. This feeling of passion and the allusions back to this somewhat like Catholic mythology that I grew up in, and this red thread of knowing right or wrong and just blasting right through it. Everything that I learned, and you know, very rarely really being that first generation that actually went to college, but still being really cognizant of my working class background. You know, I felt a lot of kinship with Kerouac. And,
was On the Road a guide for you, a life guide somehow, Michael?
Absolutely, absolutely. This, again, when I wrote poetry, just this having to get to the meat of the matter and feeling passionate about what I'm thinking about, not just taking things for face value, but really, really thinking about who I was and just feeling strongly and really not having much time for people who just were blasé about things.
Yeah, Michael, we love it, and thank you for your call. John Leland, what about that Catholicism and the search that Jack Kerouac was on? How do you define it and the place of religion in it?
It's a big part of Kerouac's life and also a big part of the book. He sets out on this on this spiritual quest. And I think that his friend John Cullen Holmes said it was a big difference between the Lost Generation writers and the Beat Generation writers, is that the Lost Generation writers were really broken in their faith. They'd seen their faith destroyed.
The post-World War I, the Hemingways, and all
yes.
the rest.
Mm-hmm. And the Beat Generations were really trying to form their faith. Their faith was strong. It needed direction and it needed relevance in their lives now.
Beat in part as beatific.
Beatific. That's how Kerouac saw it. at least how he came to describe it later in life. Mm. And there's an interesting thing in the very end of the book. He has this kind of aside, and he's at the end of his journeys, and he's off the road, and he's in New York, and he's staring out across the continent, and he's talking. He says, "And the stars will be out, and the children are crying in the land, and don't you know that God is Pooh Bear?" And then he gets back into talking about the stars, and it's a funny thing. He's taken all these journeys, and now he's finally able to name God, and it's in this kind of weird, childlike, innocent voice. And I think it fits with the kind of nostalgia and reverie that Sal Paradise, the narrator, has throughout the book.
Mm-hmm. Joyce, you described this great scene when Jack Kerouac brings the fabled scroll into the publisher, into the editor's office, and tosses it across the office like a piece of celebration confetti, the editor remembering him saying, "Here it is, written by the Holy Ghost."
That's right.
Oh, my gosh. What did he mean by that?
I think he felt that writing was a holy and ecstatic act, and I think he also felt because of the fluency with which he'd written on the road. Often writers are amazed by their own powers, like words come to them. They don't know from where. You know, it is like some force outside yourself is almost dictating your writing. That is when things are going extremely well.
Of course, then you quote John Titles, the author of Naked Angels, saying to you that it was crushing for Jack when they wanted to come in and pull a bunch out of this scroll, change it, edit it. If God had written it, John said, Jack didn't need an editor. Now the scroll text itself has been published along with this 50th anniversary.
Yes, isn't
moment.
That wonderful?
It is, but it's also such an eye opener. I mean, all the sex, just for starters, that came out in the final publication, including no small amount of homosexual sex in Jack's original scroll. You were his girlfriend, but he and his crew, Neil Cassady, and of course. Ginsberg and the rest of the world were playing all kinds of sides of the street here.
That's true. And, you know, it was a very daring act to write about that at the time. The late 1950s, those were the days when D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover was banned in the United States. If you wanted to read the novels of Henry Miller, you had to smuggle them in from France. Things were very uptight and very, very conservative.
What was it like being Jack Kerouac's girlfriend in that atmosphere? I mean, you weren't married and you weren't shy.
Well, I was living in the way that young women were not supposed to live back then, in that I had my own apartment and was self-supporting and was having a sex life without being married. I mean, we take those things for granted then, but then... Now, but at the time, that was a, you know, considered a very, very bad way for a girl to live. So I had taken this risky path, and I was out there on my own. And when On the Road was published, it was difficult to be the girlfriend of such a celebrity, because the fans were so avid. Jack was sort of swarmed everywhere we went. There were women offering themselves to him, men who, you know, who wanted to actually drink with him or get into fights with him,
just to make the touch.
Yeah, that's right. It was very disturbing to me.
And
it was having a terrible effect upon Jack, and I was only 21, and I was trying as best I could to take care of him.
He retreated in many ways, and of course, in another decade or so, was finished, and too young. Let's take a call from East Lansing, Michigan. Todd, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. What do you hear?
I have two points I'd like to make. I guess about one is a point, one is a question. I, as someone in my early 30s, feel very fortunate, as someone who considers himself fairly well-read and college-educated, that I just recently have come into the world of the Beat and the Kerouacs and the Ginsberg. It's very ironic. I actually finished On the Road about a month ago. I have a busy life and am now in the process of destroying Big Sur. I find it ironic that your program is on, and yet I'm, again, very thankful as someone who considered themselves fairly read, but and yet disappointed somewhat that this type of literature, the Beats and Jack Kerouac, were not something that I discovered early. I'm very thankful that I have, and I kind of wish that they'd have been presented to me at an earlier age and a little bit younger than my educational system, where I would have been exposed to this thinking and really the ideals of freedom and experience.
Let me ask you, Todd. I mean, you sort of came to it then as a, whatever, 35-year-old Kerouac virgin. Does it still, did it still recently for the first time seem relevant? Did it speak to you?
Yeah, you know what? It really, really did. It actually is something that, you know, of probably, you know, the you know hundreds of books I've read, I would have definitely put it in my top five. And as far as actual an emotional connection, it may be number one. It really may be. It is an experience for me, whereas, you know, I can say that a lot of the books I've read, I learned something from or I could relate to, but I view reading On the Road and Kerouac as an experience, and that's what it means to me. And I guess that's kind of the piggy bank of my question is, on this to you, to yourself and your experts, is in today's society and generation, you know, the looking for it, as Neil Cassidy would say, is experienced online or, you know, on cable TV or whatever. And to me, that's the thing about the book. And, you know, I mean, I know it was simplified by Neil into the term it, but it seems as though our generation in the United States, we want to find it. We may know that it is out there, but we really don't have a way to, we don't know how to go about looking for it. And that was the experience and the freedom that I found through this book and through his writings is, you know, that it is out there, but you have to go looking for it. You have to want to find it. It isn't going to come to you. And I guess that's my question again to you and your panel is, how do you think today's society and today's generation are going to go about finding it when you can't even get a kid to go outside and play a game of catch or walk away from his Nintendo?
Todd, you're great, and thank you very much for that. John Leland, this is right in your wheelhouse. First of all, Neil Cassidy is the it. Is that God? And do we find it on the road or online or on cable?
First of all, I love it that he's discovered the book in his mid-30s because so many of us, I think when we read it when we're 17, our hormones are going so strong that they are almost, you know, pouring onto the page and determining how we read it. So it's great that he's reading it as an older writer. And yes, this search for it is going on. And much of the book is about their travels and about their discovery of this other America. But many of the most important journeys they're making are internal, and they're looking inside themselves, and they're having these conversations with each other. So it's the road isn't the most essential part of the book. It's that questing and that, you know, I think Joyce can attest to this, you know, and that incredible power of observation of what's going on outside of you and inside of you.
You know, Joyce, I remember first reading it almost weirdly in the same summer. You know, I guess you read this depending on, you know, what generation you are. I read The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Tom Wolfe's book following Ken Kesey, and a later round of Neil Cassidy. And this in the same summer long ago, sitting out in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Wow.
It was a great back-to-back. But then I listened again. I mean, I actually did listen to it as a book on tape on a long drive. And while I found it so thrilling, you know, all those years ago as that 17-year-old or nearly that John describes, I found On the Road kind of darker and sort of sad listening to it now. And I in reading for the show, I realize I'm not the only one. A lot of people make that observation. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there is considerable darkness in the book. And there are sort of flash-forward references throughout the text of, you know, people not being the same now in the time that Jack is writing the book as they were just a few years ago, that they became sadder, they became emptier. Jack had a very, very keen sense of mortality. You know, we're all going to die. You know, that sense was with him of, you know, constantly, and it casts its shadow over the, you know, over the entire book. And one of the things that Dean says in On the Road is, we know time. And by knowing time, it means to pack as much intensity into every moment as you can through you know, through observation, through living, to be alive to what's around you. I mean, certainly the idea of people getting their experience filtered through online things or watching TV was not at all what Jack had in mind. He wanted people to go right out there and engage passionately with life itself.
No thanks to the mediated life. I don't know what he'd make of all the mediation we have now, but it wasn't, even then, John, it's not all ecstasy in here on the road.
No, he thought of it as a profoundly sad book. And there's a sense of loss that permeates throughout the book. The first line of the book, he says, he says it all began after the breakup of his first marriage. And when he typed out the scroll draft, he said, it all began with the death of my father. So it begins with loss. The two guys are searching for their fathers the whole time. Dean's father is missing, and Sal is trying to make sense of his life without a father. And so he's joining this search for Dean's father. There's a reverie for a world that was disappearing, even as Kerouac was writing about
even
it.
Even a nostalgia for the character. Depression, the hobos and all the rest, yeah.
Can I say something? It was also so much a post-war book. You know, people had come through the war. There'd been the atomic bomb. There was a general sense that God was dead. Therefore, someone with Kerouac's kind of sensibility was pretty rare, especially among writers.
John, you make much of that in your sort of life lessons drawing here.
Yes, that there is that, that sense that something has gone wrong, but it is can be repaired. There can be, we can search for beauty. We can search for an authentic, I think authenticity is one of the things they're searching for. It is possible to be an authentic man in a world that's filled with organization men and the dangers presented by the bomb. And he goes on these travels, and he's traveling east-west, east-west, east-west. And at in the fourth journey that they take, they go south, and they travel almost in time back to the pre-modern Mexico.
We're talking this hour about Jack Kerouac's Beat Generation classic, On the Road at 50. Here's Kerouac reading an undated recording again, describing the music and scene when he's been on the road in a San Francisco club.
Everybody was rocking and roaring. Our girls, Galatea and Alice, with beers in their hands, were standing on the chairs, shaking and jumping. Groups of colored studs stumbled in from the street, falling over one another to get there. "Stay with it, man!" roared a man with a foghorn voice, and let out a big groan that must have been heard clear to Sacramento. "Ha-ha!" "Wow," said Dean. He was rubbing his chest, his belly, his T-shirt was out. The sweat splashed from his face. Boom, kick! That drummer was kicking his drums down the cellar and rolling the beat upstairs with his murderous sticks. Rattledy-boom! Big fat man was jumping on the platform, making it sag and creak. Woo! The pianist was only pounding the keys with spread-eagled fingers, chords only. At intervals when the great tenor man was drawing breath for another blast of phrase.
Jack Kerouac reading from On the Road. Joyce Johnson is with us, author of Minor Characters, writer and novelist. She was Kerouac's girlfriend when the book came out in 1957. John Leland is here. His new book is Why Kerouac Matters. Dave is calling from San Francisco. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Yo, hey, I was there in 1957 in that bohemian enclave, North Beach, San Francisco, with both Kerouac and Cassidy, and that was the Cellar. That was the jazz club right there on Green Street, and I'm here 50 years later looking back. I had come earlier in response to an article by Kenneth, I was in Minneapolis, article by Kenneth Rexroth that something was happening in San Francisco in North Beach in Nation Magazine, and had hitchhiked and with Greyhound bus, and back then, 1957, so I'm really looking back. And what I remember, and what's important, Joyce, you were in that bohemian enclave, Greenwich Village. I was in North Beach, and on the road, just to remember, and it's very important, I think, to me to say this before the interstate. This was a different kind of trip. This was really in touch with America to make that drive, Jack and Neil, San Francisco, New York City, San Francisco, and back again.
What, the thing that was happening, Dave, is it happening anymore? Is there an echo of it? Is it gone?
Why, it comes up and down, up and down. It's the 40th anniversary of the Summer of Love. That was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And that was the resurrection. Beatnik plus LSD equals hippie. I was there, too. He didn't make that cut, but a lot of people do. I see Michael McClure from time to time. He made that cut and is still here on the planet. He didn't make... And one thing I wanted to say before I go on.
Yeah.
I had talked to Kerouac. I was one of those who had read The City and the Country. The Town and the City. Is that the book?
That's
a book which he had.
His first, yeah, 51.
His first, and it had come out years before, and he was really disappointed about it. It had been F-rated. He says, they destroyed that. I remember him telling me directly, they destroyed that book. So this was some years later, four or five, maybe more than that, that On the Road came out. After I knew Jack, On the Road came out, and I think that was the sign of a new time, of a new bohemia, and a new spirit in the land.
Dave, that's great testimony. Right from the time, and we're grateful for it. Joyce, what's your sense of the thing that was happening then? I mean, it always helps to have some context when we're reading, and we're reading again today On the Road. You know, can we understand what he was talking about? Has the culture changed so much that it doesn't have the same resonance, that we don't really even understand the moon and the stars he was looking at? As Dave says, we've got interstates now. When he was on that flatbed truck going across, I think it was Colorado, that was bumping and jumping, you know, that wasn't smooth interstate travel.
Well, at the time On the Road came out, I think America was ready for that. There was all this frustration with the mores of the 1950s. There were, you know, besides the Beats, there were all these great important movements in art, and in places like San Francisco and New York, there was a tremendous convergence of very talented people, all knowing each other, all in the same place. Everybody was ready for a big cultural change, more than ready. So it was though, you know, there was this bottle of champagne that had been all corked up, and then On the Road sort of was one of those books, along with Allen Ginsberg's How, that articulated all those pent-up feelings that people were having, and the cork came out of the bottle.
Jackson Pollock was swinging the paint, and Allen Ginsberg swinging the poetry. But when we read it now, John, do we need cultural interpretation to take the messages, or do they still speak straight through it?
The music of the book, I think, still speaks as strongly as it ever does. And it's wonderful that you've been playing these passages of Kerouac reading his prose. So I think in that sense, it still speaks to us. And the basic search, that search for meaning, that search for identity, that's with us today. And I think that's why the book's a rite of passage and will remain one.
Let's get one more piece of Kerouac in here, because it is great to hear it. In 1956, here he is before publication of On the Road, describing the Beat Generation.
Now it's jazz. The place is roaring. All beautiful girls in there. One mad brunette at the bar, drunk with her boys. One strange chick I remember from somewhere, wearing a simple skirt with pockets, her hands in there. Short haircut, slouch, talking to everybody. Up and down the stairs they come. The bartenders are the rummer who looks up in the sky with blue eyes, with a beard. He's wailing beer caps of bottles and jamming at the cash register, and everything is going to the beat. It's the beat generation. It's Bayat. It's the beat to keep. It's the beat of the heart. It's being beat and down in the world and like old-time lowdown. And like in ancient civilizations, the slave boatmen rowing galleys to a beat. And servants spinning pottery to a beat.
The slave boatmen rowing to the beat, servants spinning pottery to the beat. It was all about the beat. Let's go to Romero in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Romero, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for the show.
Yeah.
I just wanted to relay a story of how I came across Kerouac. I was a little bit later in the timeline there. I was born in 69.
Okay.
And in high school, we were like 80s punkers, and one of my good friends was very well read. He was really into Kerouac, and he ended up adopting the whole On the Road lifestyle. He was a drunk. He traveled hither and thither, and the way it kind of affected me was I was like, well, screw Kerouac if it's gonna take you away from me. You know, I wanted him to stay, and we were playing music and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I never read the books up until just this last year. And my friend had subsequently, he lived that lifestyle for about 5 years, and he ended up committing suicide.
Mm.
But I think he did find what he was looking for in it, however. And I subsequently have read the books and was just blown away. I mean, it has become a cornerstone of my, you know, my spiritual development. It also solidified my artistic temperament. You know, in a way, I kind of lived that way anyway, even though I didn't read his stuff back then. But I just wanted to say that I think that, you know, it's definitely has a universal message and a universal appeal that I can't imagine people not getting that same vibe today.
Romero, thank you very much for that story. And John, it's a poignant one. Romero, born in the year Jack Kerouac died. Romero's buddy, you know, taking this book as his Bible and ending up on the road and ending up a suicide. What about the way it was picked up? William Burroughs was kind of dismissive later on, you know, said that the book sold 1 trillion Levi's and 1 million espresso coffees or something and sent all these kids on the road, but wasn't so sure that it sent them to Nirvana.
There's never the promise that the road is going to be an easy place. The people that formed the Beat Generation, they'd been through a lot. There were a number of suicides in the group. You know, half the people were institutionalized at one point. People were in jail. There's a scene very early on in the book. Kerouac shows you Jane Lee, the character. She's the equivalent of Burroughs' wife. Mm-hmm. We see her wandering around Times Square carrying her baby in a Benzedrine hallucination, and she has to go to Bellevue after that. You know, this is not a protected world. It's not safe out there. You are really heading out into the unknown, and anything can happen to you.
Joyce, you know, the Kerouac that I certainly find more fun, if not more moving, is the Dharma Bums. And as you say, he'd written a bunch before On the Road came out. But there he's moving on from his Christian or Catholic church, if that's what we can call it, to a kind of Buddhist search. When you knew him, what was his attitude toward the spiritual? Heavy, light, Christian, Catholic, Buddhist, what?
It was heavy. It was a mixture of Catholicism and Buddhism. Buddhism had become increasingly important to Jack. He sort of discovered it around 1954. And, you know, during the years before On the Road was published, when he did some revisions himself, mm-hmm. that awareness of Buddhism really, really comes into the text, the final version. But in a way, Jack was sort of, Burroughs always felt, and I would agree with Burroughs, that Jack began to really sort of misuse Buddhism in a way. You know, he understood it intellectually, but he was also using it to kind of justify the kind of self-destructive life he was leading.
Self-abnegation of Buddhism or that threat of it.
You know, we're all going to die. Birth is death. We're all heading for the void. So, you know, there's nothing you can do but just sort of accept yourself and all your hopelessness. It became, I think, in a funny way, I feel that it became a kind of destructive thing for Jack.
John, atonement, redemption, divine revelation, or just losing oneself?
All of those things. You know, Kerouac came back to Catholicism, and throughout, even when he was Buddhist, Buddhism is very accommodating, and it accommodates other belief systems within it. Leonard Cohen is a practicing Jew and a Buddhist, or an observant Jew and a Buddhist. And, you know, Kerouac fought with friends over spiritual matters. He fell out with Neil and Carolyn Cassidy over their devotion to Edgar Cayce, who had theories about reincarnation. And he fought with Gary Snyder, with whom he was very close, over different schools of Buddhism. And Snyder was, I think, a teacher to him in this as well. And Snyder is the protagonist of the Dharma Bums. But they are searching for that kind of enlightenment and revelation. But it's not something that once you know the secret, you can go on and everything's going to be cozy.
Let's take a call from Simon in Aiken, South Carolina. Simon, you're on the air.
Oh, hey. I love the show.
Thank you.
I want to say hi, Joyce. Hi.
Hi.
My question is, one thing that's always baffled me about Kerouac is the resistance in academia to his work, especially compared to Ginsberg. Howl gets into the Norton Anthology, but nothing from On the Road gets in there. And Howl is a whole lot more radical, and Ginsberg is a whole lot more radical in his beliefs than Kerouac. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about why, at least my perception is there's a resistance in academia. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about why there would be some sort of resistance to Kerouac, even though it's widely considered, you know, the great American novel. A lot of people love it.
Yeah, Joyce, what about it? You know Columbia and NYU and more well. What about it?
Well, there was a tremendous resistance to On the Road. It was considered an outlaw book for decades. In fact, people who were going to do graduate studies and wanted to write on Kerouac were often in a lot of trouble. I think all this started back, you know, when On the Road was published. In a way, the whole story of the spontaneous way On the Road was composed gave academic critics a lot of ammunition. You know, as Capote said, this isn't writing; it's typing. They didn't get it. They felt threatened by it. The values in the book were not the values of the academy. There was also a lot of snobbery, directed toward Jack. He wasn't from the WASPy.
He's a working class kid to Columbia on a football scholarship.
Kid, mm-hmm. French Canadian. He was considered a kind of savage.
But that's a harsh category indeed. But he had the last laugh, I guess. John's calling from Taunton, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air. Hello, John.
I love your show. I'm a first-time caller.
Thank you. Great to have you.
I like you, also prefer Dharma Bums to On the Road. I think it was a very fun book. It came at a great time in my life. I was 16 years old when I started reading Jack Kerouac. Mm. Basically, in reading Kerouac, it led me on a path of curiosity about Buddhism, which I feel to this day still shapes my worldview. Just different aspects of Jack Kerouac. I mean, he really lived a life on his own terms. He believed in thinking and perceiving and deciding what's what about the world in his own way. He essentially broke the social molds of his time, which I just wanted to say to this day rings in my own life, and love Jack Kerouac, very influential figure in my own life to this day.
Let freedom ring right off that road. We've got it, John, and thank you very much for that. John Leland, I don't know, give us your bottom line takeaway. You're looking at life lessons here. Does it boil down, or do we have to travel the 1,000 miles to know it?
You still have to travel the 1,000 miles to know it. But the book, I think, the important thing to know is the book is not a book about Peter Pan, about that you don't have to grow up. It's a book about the tension between, the heart of the book is the tension between these two characters, one who does not. He has this tremendous life force, but remains the same over the course of the book. And the other, the narrator Sal Paradise, who basically has to outgrow his friend over the course of the novel and ends the book not on the road, but off the road, able to reflect on it and also able to do what he was called to do, which is to write.
Neil Cassady, of course, found dead by a railway track in Mexico in 1968. Jack Kerouac dead in 1969. Joyce, do you still read it? Do you still look back, or is it just too deep a bit of time travel to pick it up now?
Oh, I still look back. I still read On the Road. Every time I read it, I discover new wonderful passages in it, new meanings. I've taught it in my classes and MFA programs, and it's so meaningful to so many of my students.
Still sells 100,000 copies a year, which is huge for a book from that era, and still a lot of enthusiasm for it that we hear. Joyce Johnson, we're very grateful to you for being with us, author of Minor Characters. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
And John Leland, author of Why Kerouac Matters. John, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.